Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class in Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on November 11, 2017. This is the third of four talks on the meaning of awakening in the context of Four Noble Truths. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
See you Tuesday. Thanks for the review. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, everyone. And today's talk is the third of four on what it means to awaken to each of the Four Noble Truths. I'll read what I finished with last week, the Buddha's words. When ignorance is abandoned and right understanding has arisen, one no longer clings to sensual pleasures. One no longer clings to wrong views or deluded views. One no longer clings to rules and observances. One no longer clings to a doctrine of self. One is not agitated. One personally attains nibbana. Nibbana means to extinguish, as to extinguish the fires of passion that would keep us creating or attempting to create and satiate a self-referential ego self. Another word for nibbana would be an awakened. Awakened human being means one who is, has gained full maturity, which relates right back to the beginning of understanding the true nature of life in the phenomenal world. And even that needs a little bit of a clarification. I was thinking about this morning in relation to something I'm going to read. Often it's said that awakening means understanding the true nature of reality, but even that can be a little misleading because we're not so concerned about understanding the reality of life on Mars or the life of a dog or the life of a tree. Those things are important because they're part of the phenomenal world. What we're attempting to develop an understanding is an understanding of the three marks of existence, of the impermanent nature of all things, the not-self characteristic and how that characteristic can become confused because of ignorance, and the resulting suffering that arises because of a misunderstanding of those first two. And that's really what the whole Buddha's teachings are about. The Buddha describes awakening to the third noble truth as experiencing the cessation of suffering. So in order to experience anything, we first have to understand it, don't we? In order to fully experience anything, to fully experience a baseball game, if you don't understand what baseball is about and you just go sit there and look at it, it's probably going to seem pretty silly, a bunch of grown men chasing a ball. When you understand the game and you have a certain appreciation for the game, then it has some meaning for you. But until you actually understand the underlying nature of anything, you can't have the real experience of it, and so there's no meaning to it. So when the Buddha is talking about experiencing the cessation of suffering, we first have to understand its nature, don't we? That's what the Buddha started out with, with describing the problem. The common human problem for all human beings is dukkha. And it really is the preoccupation with dukkha that causes ongoing confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. And that is what is rooted in ignorance, ignorance of the nature of that. Am I clear where I'm going? I'm trying to synopsize the first 2 weeks, really. And so then the Buddha describes that craving originates and clinging perpetuates that dukkha, that unsatisfactory nature to human life. Ultimately, it's the craving for the continued establishment of that which can't be established that causes the ongoing problem, a permanent self. A permanent self rooted in those initial wrong views. And once that self has been established, we cling to anything that we've used to establish that self. And by that I mean any thought, word, or idea or experience that we've had that we've used to establish a self, a permanent self in a realm that can't be, that is always impermanent. Is that clear? In simple terms, we establish ourselves by what we like, and we establish a self-referential self, I mean, by what we like, what we feel we need to be happy and satisfied, and what we hope to avoid. And we spend our whole life preoccupied with chasing after what gives us pleasure and what we think will give us security, and avoiding anything that we think might take away from that.
Do you think a child can understand that?
Well, physiologically, a child really doesn't have any even self-referential understanding until 4, 5, 6, 7, and it starts to develop. And usually by 11 or 12, a basic understanding of this. But when I teach kids that young, I think the youngest I've had was probably 12 or 13, I don't start with any of these concepts. It's just, they don't really have a frame of reference in which to see it. The best way to teach a child, and we all know, I mean, if you have kids, well, I don't have kids, but I know this anyway, is to really to teach the moral aspects of right speech, right action, and right livelihood, not because of some type of punishment that will result from that, but simply because of developing an understanding of the harm that it brings to the child. So I'll always start with a young kid with teaching them about right speech, you know, and I'll usually say something like this, that, did you ever notice that when you're with one of your friends and you're talking about another friend that's not there and you say something that's not so nice, that you don't feel good? And invariably the kid will say, yeah, I really don't feel good. Well, that's the point. That's an aspect of wrong speech, because it hurts everyone. And it's not a big deal to a child or even an adult to recognize that. You're not gonna have prolonged suffering because you've engaged in gossip. But you realize that it's hurtful towards yourself and others. So that's a good way to start with kids. But these conceptual ways, I think it's a little bit too early. Even the Rahuluvada Sutta, where the Buddha teaches his son, he teaches his son the hurtfulness of mindlessness by, after he caught Rahula in a lie, and explaining to him how hurtful living your life based on untruths is. And this is, Rahula was 7 at the time. You know, there's a very, really great teaching for anyone on the proper application of mindfulness. Thanks for the question, Diane. It was an important question. The Buddha describes awakening very simply and directly. The noble truth of dukkha has been comprehended, but at a very deep and penetrating level, we understand the nature of suffering. The noble truth of the origination of dukkha has been abandoned. We've abandoned craving and clinging. That leads to the second factor of the Eightfold Path, right intention, which is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. The Buddha continues, the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, has been experienced, and that relates to today's teaching. We've actually had the experience of it. We know it. You know, the Buddha describes that awakening mind as a mind that knows what it's experiencing now. It's no longer clouded in any way by ignorance. The Buddha continues describing awakening as the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha has been developed. The only path the Buddha taught for the 45 years of his teaching career was the Eightfold Path. And of course, he would always refer back to that path as what is necessary to develop to awaken. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit in the article. When the first noble truth is viewed in the context as a foundation of a set of teachings whose sole purpose is to extinguish all causes of stress, all craving arising from ignorance, the end of delusion, and awakening to the true nature of existence, the statement, life is stressful, is simply an accurate, unambiguous, and completely realistic view of the condition caused by ignorance. So, for people first coming to the Buddhist teachings, and often even in modern Buddhism and in modern New Age spirituality, that statement that life is stressful is taken as, boy, the Buddha is really a negative person, and he's teaching something that is only based on suffering. And of course he's not. He's pointing out the problem so to bring awareness of our own preoccupation with trying to avoid anything that we might consider suffering. We first have to know where we are, meaning what our life experience is framed by is a mind that is reacting to dukkha constantly preoccupied with dukkha. We have to know where we are. I often make that statement that was given to me by Arnold Patton, that if you're in New York and you want to get to Chicago, but you believe you're in Los Angeles, you're not going anywhere. You simply have to know where you are. You have to know what you have to work with and where you're beginning. Life is stressful. Stress is a condition caused by ignorance. Ignorance is a lack of clear understanding. Stress is the impermanent manifestation in the phenomenal world arising from lack of wisdom. When the Buddha awakened, he awakened to dependent origination. Again, something that is wildly misunderstood and misapplied. Dependent origination simply states from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of suffering arises. So the first teaching he gave was this Four Noble Truths, so that we can awaken to an understanding of suffering, to develop wisdom where there was once ignorance. Dukkha or stress is delusion. Stress is the veil obscuring reality. Again, it's the preoccupation with dukkha that creates that veil of ignorance, so we don't even understand what's occurring in the world. We don't understand who we are. So we start creating very subtle but very powerful strategies that would ignore that initial ignorance. And much of what has developed in the world during the Buddha's time, before the Buddha's time, and certainly in the 2600 years since his passing, is to continue to ignore ignorance.
Defense mechanisms.
Exactly. So that but defense mechanisms against something that's not even there. There's no substantiality, except we think that there's substance to what we've created. Most of the big money that has been made by people that have been able to figure out a way to keep us more deeply distracted than other ways. One of the presidents, the past, he's not a president anymore, of Facebook, finally admitted, I couldn't believe what he said, that him and Jeff Zuckerberg created a system intentionally to distract us. They knew what they were doing. And he even alluded, he didn't come right out and say it, that they had a moral discussion about whether they should even do this, and they decided, let's go for the money. He spoke out because he was now saying the danger of this constantly engaged with social media is so damaging to children because of that preoccupation. When I think of that, when I see children or people with their face always engaged in something, it reminds me of something that I was engaged with for many years, drug addiction and alcoholism. A constant preoccupation with something. And it would not surprise me if 5 or 10 years ago they start legislating about when you're old enough to have a smartphone. Because, again, the I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but it was so shocking to me that this gentleman admitted their strategy was to find a way to greatly distract human beings, and they certainly succeeded. That relates back to this, that the things that we're most enamored with, that we spend the most money on, and I'm talking about as a society, maybe not necessarily people in this room, are the things that prove the greatest distractions to us. And it's always been that way. You know, when I was growing up, we didn't have all the distractions, but we had movies. And so we go to movies a lot, and that was a great distraction. And the people that could entertain us the most to the point of the greatest distraction are those that made the biggest bucks. I mean, isn't that true? So we've created, as a society, we've created a world that is based on satiating that desire for constant distraction, and it works very well. When the Buddha talks about awakening, when I talk about awakening, it's in relation to disentangling ourselves from all those things that we're attached to in the outer world. And again, I don't want to sound like I'm a Luddite, and you should never be on your telephone, you should never use Facebook or Twitter, you shouldn't use a computer, I'm using all those things right now. But use them with wisdom and discernment. Practice restraint. Continual reaction to dukkha, to stress, perpetuates and deepens ignorance. Continual reaction to stress further conditions conditioned mind. We just get caught up in that feedback loop that we talk about often, of self-referential views bouncing off of that conditioned need for constant engagement. Integrating the Eightfold Path into one's life directs our minds from the continual pursuit of pleasure and stress relief to experiencing the reality hidden by the veil of stress. The simple act of meditation within the proper framework of the Eightfold Path used appropriately, meaning for deepening concentration and for no other reason, immediately begins to interrupt that process of constant engagement with the outer world. And that outer world is playing out in this story that we're telling ourselves continually, one thought leading to the next thought, to the next thought. Is that clear? So that's the reason why the Buddha taught meditation, for deepening concentration, to interrupt that conditioned thinking. But then we need the broader framework of the Eightfold Path to finally bring that process to cessation. Integrating the Eightfold, I read that already, excuse me. Even spiritual pursuits of the elimination of stress can itself obscure reality. In other words, if we're engaging in spiritual practices for the for another escape from the reality of what's occurring, or, this is really kind of the same thing, or to fix what we think is a broken self, only reinforces those views. So we're not here to fix a broken self. We're simply to recognize ignorance and empty ourselves of that ignorance. That's the whole purpose of the Eightfold Path. Because anything else is putting energy into something which is, as the Buddha describes, like foam on the ocean. There's nothing broken. It's just a level of ignorance that we need to be aware of. The Buddha asks this question and then describes the third noble truth. What is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering? It is the complete cessation of that very craving, giving it up, relinquishing it, abandoning it, liberating oneself from that very craving. And we're talking now of not so much about craving for chocolate cake or the next wonderful conversation or a great meal or the perfect round of golf or anything else, although those are the distractions along the way. What we're talking about is abandoning the craving that would establish a self-referential ego self in this moment and as life occurs, to recognize those views that are rooted in ignorance that would create that craving in the first place. Remember, in dependent origination, the sixth factor is craving leads to clinging and clinging and maintaining. In other words, craving is the requisite condition for clinging and maintaining. Craving is a requisite condition that leads to clinging to the establishment of a self-referential ego self. And then in the next section of dependent origination is that leads to further becoming. And the relation to the name of the book, Becoming Buddha, Becoming Awakened, what that means is that each moment holds the potential to either become more ignorant, if what we're continuing is that ignorance, or to develop the Eightfold Path and to become awakened. That's the real choice that that each moment holds for us. And that's the important thing to remember. We shouldn't get so fixated on, am I moving towards awakening in this moment? Because that itself can be a distraction. But understand that there's no such thing as the present moment. There's no such thing as a fixed point in time that we can discern. It's useful to discern. But to recognize that we are always in a process of becoming. That's a true understanding of impermanent. And that leads directly to the question, well, what am I going to become in this moment? Am I going to become more ignorant, or am I going to become awakened? If we're going to become awakened, we develop the framework of the Eightfold Path. We'll talk a little bit more about that next week. Liberating oneself from that very, very craving and detaching oneself from it. These are all direct actions, aren't they? Detaching oneself, abandoning craving, abandoning ignorance, emptying oneself of ignorance are direct actions that we take within ourselves and within our own minds. It's not something that just happens. It doesn't occur because we meditate long enough and hard enough. It doesn't happen because we worship certain Buddhas or Devas or other incarnate, disincarnate beings. It doesn't happen because we're living perfectly moral lives, although that's important. It happens because we recognize and abandon our own ignorance. That's what the Buddha awakened to. That's what he taught. The Buddha described the three linked characteristics of life as anicca, impermanence, dukkha, stress, and anatta, the not-self characteristic. It is due to a lack of understanding of impermanence that stress arises. Those things that bring pleasure, safety, and security are fleeting. And because of that, attachment arises to the things that are giving us pleasure. We know that they're impermanent because we experience it. And yet, because we've created an identity over it, we're now attached to it. And so the natural arising and passing away of all phenomena, once we've created an attachment to it and an identity about it, creates stress. And it cannot be avoided at that point because we've already created an identity over what we think we need. And we've now created a permanent identity based on that. In other words, we resist even the change in those beliefs once we've created the belief. Even when we know to a great extent that those beliefs are causing us harm in some ways. It's the essence of compulsion and addiction. Continues to cause suffering in our lives, yet we'll attach ourselves. So now I'm not just talking about substance abuse. We do that with just about everything. And maybe more so to views that we recognize create this harmony in our lives, but we'll still attach to them because we've created an identity over them. That's really the problem, the biggest problem, what's going on in the world today. Through lack of wisdom, we get entangled in the struggle against stress. The struggle becomes part of the stress itself, and discursive thinking and behavior is the result. Stress is as impermanent as any other phenomena, and through integrating a practice whose sole purpose is to see this clearly and abandon endless craving and clinging, stress can finally be put aside. Awakening to the third noble truth is the experience of the cessation of suffering. Awakening is lifting the veil of stress that is obscuring the true nature of reality. That's the line I wanted to change. Awakening to the true nature of self is really more accurate. Awakening is true freedom from and liberation from the never-ending confusion arising from the desire that life in the phenomenal world be any different than it is. That last line, that ending the need for life to be any different than it is moment by moment, is described by the Buddha as an awakened mind, a mind that is always at peace and calm, a mind that is resting in equanimity. There's no self-referential self now left to be disturbed by anything that's occurring. That's an awakened human being. A self-referential ego self's next question usually is, well, what happens to me when I have that calm and peaceful mind? In other words, that's not enough, is it, for a self-referential ego self? A self-referential ego self always needs more. In the Kula Vidala Sutta, where the nun teaches her husband Visakha the entire path to awakening, Visakha gets it and he understands that mind of calm and peace, and yet he still asks his ex-wife Dhammadina, what's after that? It's not enough, is it, to a self-referential ego self, a mind of lasting peace and happiness. A self-referential ego self always needs something to continue to stimulate itself, to continue to establish itself in the world. The Buddha recognized that that is a view that's rooted in ignorance, that it's a never-ending quest because it's not something that can ever be achieved. Something that is rooted in ignorance can never be satisfied, because it can only reflect that ignorance. But an awakened, fully mature human being who has recognized the futility of chasing after what is like foam on the ocean and takes life and finds great meaning in life as life occurs no longer needs that life to be any different than what is occurring. An awakened mind fully understands what an unawakened mind usually gets very confused and kind of tied together: acceptance and approval. A self-referential ego self, anatta, a mind rooted in ignorance, always has those things attached, meaning it always has to approve of things before it can accept anything, which ultimately means it can't accept anything, can it? Because nothing can be fully approved because nothing is ever permanent. But as we awaken, we learn to separate those two things, and we no longer need to approve anything, and we learn to accept everything. Why? Because it's simply what's occurring. Again, referring back to that what awakening means, a full human maturity, isn't the essence of a mature human being to accept what's occurring? Again, it doesn't mean you approve it, but you accept it because it's what's occurring in your life, isn't it? And yet most of us, lacking that wisdom, fight what is occurring all the time. It's not enough, or there's too much of it. Right? I mean, isn't that the essence of the troubles we create in our own minds? I need more of this or I need less of this. This experience I'm having right now is unacceptable. That's crazy, isn't it? Crazy meaning lacking wisdom. It's occurring. It has to be accepted. But But again, we don't have to approve of it. Yes, Sandy?
So, I mean, things are occurring and we accept them, but yet we still make choices.
Yes. And I can tell by the comment that you really have an understanding of the implication of this. But when those choices are based on true wisdom, meaning understanding the true nature of life in the world, those choices always lead to more peace and more calm. When those choices are rooted in ignorance, they usually will only continue that ignorance leading to more confusion and stress. So we don't lose, an awakened human being certainly doesn't lose the ability to choose, but they choose wisely. They choose from a view that is rooted in right view rather than wrong view. The Buddha started, the Eightfold Path begins with right view. Right view is a view that completely understands at a deep and profound level the true nature of life in the world, meaning it understands the three marks of existence. But it's such an important question. So and it leads to something. We've all made choices in the past that after we felt the consequences of them, we wish we made different choices, didn't we? There is a writer that I read many years ago. His name was Og Mandino. He was an interesting guy, wrote some pretty interesting books. During that, the spiritual success kind of book craze started way back when with U.S. Anderson and Napoleon Hill. He was in the, Og Mandino was in the 80s, in early 90s. You might have read The Greatest Salesman in the World. That's his famous book. He's a really good writer. He wasn't teaching Buddhism or anything like that. He wrote one book called The Choice, and the whole book was about the importance of recognizing the effects of each and every choice we make because of where those choices will lead us. So seemingly insignificant choices can have very, very significant impacts on our lives. And what Sandy was talking about, that when we can begin to make our choices rooted in understanding of how things truly are, those choices continue us on that path towards awakening, towards developing a life of peace and happiness. When we make choices that are based on ignorance or deluded thinking, and I'm not just saying that every one of those choices will lead to suffering, but they can only continue ignorance.
Part of karma, isn't it?
It is. So the Buddha taught the Eightfold Path as a way of recognizing deluded thinking and poor choices resulting from that and developing a way of making wise choices and leading towards awakening. Again, the Eightfold Path was taught because the Buddha understands that a mind rooted in ignorance, a deluded mind, has no way of recognizing its delusion. Now think about that for a moment. A deluded mind has no way of recognizing its own delusion. It's the essence of a deluded mind. So the Buddha taught a framework to recognize that, rooted in concentration, developed through shamatha vipassana meditation, and then framed by the refined mindfulness of the other seven factors, we're able to directly confront our own ignorance. And as we confront the results of our ignorance, we make different choices. And that choice, another way of saying different, what guides those choices is the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path, right effort. We'll talk more about this next week. Right effort or skillful effort implies that there's such a thing as wrong effort or unskillful effort, doesn't it? So anything that we do, any choice that we make that's rooted in ignorance will only continue that ignorance. Right effort, as we develop the framework of the Eightfold Path, guides us towards making more skillful choices. Well, thank you again, Sandy, for bringing that up, because it really, really puts a good point on there, a fine point. As we make more skillful choices, the stress reduces in our life, and at the same time, we're reducing that conditioned thinking. And as conditioned thinking diminishes, we're able to see more and more and integrate more and more the Eightfold Path. What Anthony brought up isn't that karma. Karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level of our mindfulness. And if the present level of our mindfulness is framed by the Eightfold Path, then we're taking that momentum of past intentional actions and inclining it towards awakening rather than using that momentum to continue to further ignorance. And that's that's a brief teaching on the meaning of karma. Karma is not some kind of overarching spiritual process that's punishing us for past acts or rewarding us for current acts. It's simply what's occurring in our life as a result of choices that we've made, rooted in ignorance or rooted in wisdom. Thank you for pointing that out, too. Was that, I cut you off a little bit, too.
No, you nailed it.
Okay. So the third noble truth is having the experience of the cessation of suffering, of dukkha. Does everyone here feel that that's attainable? I had a class similar on Tuesday night. It was touching on this in relation to the Eightfold Path.
Awakening?
This experiencing the cessation of dukkha, yes.
I feel like, the way to start it out is just by each moment, just trying to respond to whatever you're experiencing in a skillful way.
Yes.
And then that just keeps building on, one moment builds on another, and you become more confident in your wisdom when you become more peaceful.
Yes, thank you. And the framework for doing that is the Eightfold Path. That's when we develop and integrate the Eightfold Path, then each moment is framed by that understanding. Again, the reason why I teach that and the Buddha taught that is he recognized that a conditioned mind will often ignore what's occurring, even if it's causing stress. So it takes a little bit more of that refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, but Sandy's exactly right. Being present with your life as life occurs, framed by the Eightfold Path, is the path for developing awakening. We'll touch more on that next week. So let's go around the room and see what you have to say. Mike, good to see you this morning.
Thanks, Sean. Good to see you. Good to be here. I was actually going to ask about the choices that we just addressed. So, as you just said, you nailed it. I don't really have anything to add this morning. That covered what I was thinking about.
That's an important thing, too, isn't it? I mean, it really is kind of the whole of it. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Sandy, welcome to our Sangha. And,
thank
you for your contribution so far. It was great. Anything else you'd like to add?
Wonderful talk. No, I think I'll just listen for now.
Good. I'm glad you're here. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. Glad to get back to the practice because it's not something I can keep up that much when I'm away. I tried like meditating, but it's really tough in a hotel room with all the stuff going on. And I couldn't do it twice a day, so I'm glad to get back to that practice.
Glad you're back.
Thanks for your talk. I mean, it was good. And to answer your question about whether it's attainable, I feel like it's, for me, something that I always am I'm better at recognizing the problems as they arise but the actual, I don't know that I can actually always be in a peaceful state. I think that the stress will boil up and I can deal with it better. And most of the time I can make the right decision, but to be perfect at it, that's really difficult. I mean, I think it's something that I could going to continue to work on for the rest of my life, and I'd like to think maybe when I hit 80 or something that I could have almost a Buddha-like state. but boy, stress always comes up and challenges always come up. And I was wondering, it's interesting the Buddha chose the word stress, because every time I think of something in a negative way, I then reframe it as a challenge. So I try not to say something is bad. I just, or this is a bad time I'm going through, or this is why me? I just go, wow, this is challenging, you know? And that helps me to realize that it's not always going to be happy.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know that I'll ever be at a point where I am able to make perfect decisions and not experience stress, but I certainly am better at having the stress last for a shorter period, and managing a crisis in a better way than I would have before.
And I mean, and that alone is worth it, you know.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that. The Buddha never used the word stress. That's the translation of dukkha into English, but it's probably the best one that we have. Dukkha means every type of disappointing and unsatisfactory experience that we have, all the way up to extreme emotional and physical suffering. It covers all of that, which is kind of the underlying human experience. And so the Buddha, in teaching the First Noble Truth, simply states that as a consequence of having a human life, there will be dukkha, there will be stress. And it's the underlying preoccupation with that that creates the ongoing problem or contribution. But when he described it, he described dukkha as birth is stressful, painful, suffering. Aging is stressful. Sickness is stressful. Death is stressful. Not getting what is desired is stressful. Receiving what is undesired is stressful. Those are obvious, aren't they? Why did it take an awakened human being to make a point of it? It's because we become so preoccupied with it that we want to ignore it. And so the underlying problem isn't so much recognizing that something comes up that's stressful, it's reacting to it. So you've heard me say that we learn to be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. And that's exactly what you're describing. Something comes up that's stressful, but you're able to maintain at least a measure of equanimity with that stress.
Yeah, and what I do, I always try to think of it like, we can disagree, but we don't have to be disagreeable.
Exactly, that's a great way of putting it. There's always going to be stress in life. As a consequence of human life, again, the First Noble Truth, there will be stress. One of these days I'll teach the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, but it's a long one, I'm going to fit it in. In that sutta, and there's other times in the suttas, where the Buddha describes being in severe physical pain. He died because of food poisoning, and he describes the whole process in detail. That's stressful to any human being. The Buddha felt pain. He didn't become superhuman, but he didn't react to it. In fact, he knew who poisoned him accidentally. He didn't blame that person. He didn't seek revenge. In fact, he went out of his way to say, don't tell Kunda what happened, because he didn't want Kunda to feel bad. But he still suffered the physical pain of it. But he didn't react. He was able to be at peace with that less than peaceful mind and body state. And he passed in peace. So thank you. And it's important that you recognize that, or that we all recognize the practical developments of the Dhamma in that way. So thank you. Jen, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you too. To answer your question, I feel like with the big things, sure. With the everyday little things, the moment to moment craving and clinging, it's definitely not as straightforward. But I see that it's attainable.
Good.
And something that you said kind of clicked, because you were talking about, craving. Already craving for something. Let's use your chocolate cake example. You're already craving, you've had a piece, it was delicious, it felt amazing, you want another piece, you're already attached to the outcome, or you've already clung yourself to the idea that I will be as happy if I have another piece of chocolate cake. And so noticing that, you're attached to that outcome, noticing that you are defining your future happiness based on chocolate cake. If you can do that, oh, that's ridiculous. That's not real. It's probably going to make me sick. But once you're craving it, you're already in there.
Yep.
And that's the part, like you're talking about, how does a deluded mind. So if you can pause and just notice, wow, I'm defining my future happiness based on this. That's not real.
Yeah.
That something happened there, so thank you.
Thank you. And it's at that point that we practice restraint, wherever it is along that line,
mm-hmm.
whether it's after the first piece of cake or the second whole cake that we've eaten.
Right.
At some point, we have to bring in restraint. And every time we do that, no matter how far down that particular line we've gone, we're interrupting the process. And because of conditioned mind or habitual thinking, we often have to do it over and over again until it takes hold. But if you think about that mind when it's halfway through that piece of chocolate cake, has the senses have become inflamed
right.
by the great taste, and also just the satiation of taking away a little bit of hunger. A conditioned mind is already going past that moment and saying it needs more. Because in this moment, it feels good and it's doing something for me. So I need to, and because I'm attached myself to that moment, I need to continue the moment indefinitely as far as I can, as long as I can. It's the essence of addiction or compulsive behavior. But we do it, again, with not just substances. We do it with just about everything when that mind has lost control of itself. Referring back to Vitakasanthana Sutta, the Buddha teaches that we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. It's a counter to that. Sandy?
I feel like we're constantly telling, our mind is like making up a story constantly. And if we can, the trick is to break it down, you know, and to bring it back to the body, like, how's this really making me feel? What do I feel in my body at this time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, not that it's that easy to do, but I mean, that's the practice, I guess.
It's an important part of the practice, recognizing the story. One of the things that we, in this meditation method, when we recognize that we're caught up in our thoughts and come back to the sensation of breathing, which is the essence of this meditation method, what we're doing is interrupting that story that we're always telling ourselves. And it's that story that keeps that the anatta, the self-referential ego self, engaged with and thinking that it's established. So every time we can do that, recognize we're in that story, come back to the sensation of breathing, we're interrupting the story, and then off our concentration, off our cushions, we have that deepening concentration and the framework to recognize our engagement with our story off our cushion. So the story can be could be a metaphor for our own minds rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So you bring up such great points. Thank you. Diane, good to see you this morning.
I'm just continuing the conversation. I call that part of me that chooses. I have a me that chooses. And I mean, it's not necessarily an I-making kind of a thing, but it comes in on that chocolate cake kind of thing. I've been transitioning over the last 20 years into organic eating, and anymore, when I have a chocolate cake, it doesn't taste as good as some part of my ego mind tells me it should. The same with, you know, McDonald's fries and a milkshake. I used to crave those, and lately they just have lost their taste. And which is really cool, because then me that chooses comes in and says, "Oh, that's not what you thought it was, and there's something else that'll make you feel better," and I go in that direction. I just recently got back, well, a month ago now, got back from a 2.5 month stint in Arizona on a caregiving job, and I was able to swim while I was there, and because it was so hot, 113 degrees, and I was swimming outside, and the pool was hot and everything, my muscles and everything just, you know, really got into swimming, and I pulled a bunch of muscles. And when I came back through Colorado and then to New Jersey, and the whole climate change thing, I mean, the whole experience was a test of my meditation and everything. that was going on, it taught me about the people you associate with on a day-to-day basis, like live with. If you do, makes a big difference. If I'd have known this when I was 18, you know, or what marriage was about and all that kind of stuff, I was caring for a person who was very negative. Every word out of his mouth was negativity, and he was going through a tough time, but anyway, it just was a challenge. Anyway, so long story short, since I've been home, my muscles, especially in my feet, just kind of contracted. I knew that it wasn't a bone spur or anything like that, but I got in such pain that I couldn't walk, and going up and down stairs, I had to sit on the steps, and I thought maybe I'm exhausted, and I just would lay in bed. But then, and I was thinking of Buddha saying, you know, we get old age is, you know, not fun, and I was laying in bed thinking that, and I thought, well, but I have to go to the bathroom. How can I go to the bathroom laying in my bed? So I would have to get up, and I would shuffle and painfully, you know, make my way to the bathroom. And I was thinking all these Buddhist kind of thoughts all the way, you know, of pain and all that kind of stuff. And I got, I guess maybe 4 or 5 days into this not being able to walk. And that's basically my job. I mean, what can you do if you can't walk? And I got to the point where I said, I love my feet just the way they are. And I could actually palpably feel my feet change. And I know that probably, I don't know what it sounds like, but I was amazed. And from that point on, I started to care for my feet. And then I was thinking of the meta part of this practice. And I have never, in the last two to three weeks, I have never experienced such resistance to take care of myself. I knew what I needed to ice and rest and massage. I knew what to do to take care of my feet, but I did not want to do it. I didn't want to do it. I wanted to be up and around. I wanted to be walking. I had a lot of other things to do. I forced myself to work in this awful pain. I was just so, I don't think really in my life resisted anything so much as taking care of my feet. And then finally, it was just this me that chooses in me said, well, so what are you going to do? Are you going to hurt your feet further? Or are you going to heal? And you know how to do that. And it was just like this practice of meditation. It's sometimes I just have to, you know, pick myself up and put myself on the cushion and say, do it. And no matter what you think or want to do or anything. And it was not easy. It was. But the whole thing about this last 3 or 4 month experience that I've had was because of my practice of meditation, there has been an underlying peace of mind that I didn't really know was there. And it like sustained me through some of the most stressful thing that I ever had to do. And it's like this, that from that wellspring, whatever that is, comes this me that chooses, that chose to take care of my feet, that chose to do what I needed to do. And it's just, I'm kind of in awe of when you read that, you know, meditation is about getting to know your own mind. I mean, it's wow. It's like I thought it was only that part of me that wanted the milkshake and fries. There's another part that I've completely ignored, and it's there.
Thank you, Diane. You describe so beautifully that when you get caught up in all these different troubled mind states, that there's always this, when you have engaged in right effort, there's that underlying peace that you can always take refuge in. And that's really what sustains us during the process of awakening. You know, that the idea of taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha is so important to keep in mind, because it is a true refuge, whether it's, you know, 20 minutes twice a day on our cushion, or the developing mindfulness of being able to remain at peace with less than peaceful mind states. Mm-hmm. That's what keeps us going. Thank you. Mary, good to see you this morning. How are you?
I mean, for me, the biggest takeaway is making myself realize that I can't change what's going on at the moment, mm-hmm. that it's going on, and, you know, and I know when I think back on when I'm more peaceful and calm and content, it's because I'm just going with the flow, not that I like it, aka listening to the news, and not feeling the need, I've got to change this. You know, this is what is occurring, and you can change it by living your life differently and making choices when you vote, but you can't change what is going on at this very moment. It is what's happening, and that's that. It's hard to hold on to that all the time, but at least the spark is there.
Yeah, thank you. And so you're learning at a very profound level, integrating at a very profound level, the understanding that you don't need to approve of something, but you can accept it.
Yeah.
And for the most realistic of reasons, you accept it because it's what's occurring. And then you can take mindful choices and mindful actions that may have a useful impact, rather than reacting to something because it has to be different. This can't be what it is. Thank you. I'm glad you're here this morning. Tom, good to see you. It's been a little while.
Yeah, it has been. You know, to answer the question of the lead in the cessation of dukkha and following the Eightfold Path to lead to that, I've definitely experienced that by coming here and by meditation and or at least down that path. And so that, you know, I'm glad to be back here. But, you know, it's in every, I'm trying to think of it in a middle road as, you know, as opposed to a perfection every day. And I definitely struggle with perfectionism and thinking I have to be perfect at everything. And understanding that I'm human and I'm not perfect. And that kind of comes in with the practice as well, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's that balance between, you know, putting that right effort in, but having compassion when, you know, you just don't have time to meditate or whatever. But it's been there the whole time since I started coming here, and, you know, the meditation has, to, you know, more or less, sometimes it's more and sometimes it's less. It's kind of interesting as far, I was thinking about, I always love the story of the two arrows.
Yeah, Salata Sutta.
And, you know, it's interesting how my level of dukkha, you know, whether it's both arrows in life, as that level of, as my stress levels go up, my meditation goes down. And it's kind of like the chicken or the egg, right? It's, you know, the first arrow stuff of just the stress of life, as that kind of comes up, you know, I can choose whether to continue to meditate or not, or I can choose to, you know, have the second arrow where I'm causing myself additional dukkha by not doing the things that I know I should be doing, like meditating.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was able to meditate and continue the practice and come here on Saturdays or whatever other day, the first arrow things in life didn't hurt as much, or didn't, you know, didn't the sting a little bit, but then it also, that additional stress that I caused myself wasn't there as much. So it's not that exponential stress of, everything that's going on. So I think that's really kind of what I try to focus on is just keeping the meditation there. And really, meditation being there without coming to the class, it's hard to be as mindful of these things.
Oh, yeah.
Doing the meetings, it's hard to keep these things in my mind to really stay in, away from delusion and staying within the true nature of life. And I think the meditation really helps kind of prune the delusional thoughts because you're stopping that. Like Sandy was talking about, he's building a story. I think the story in my head a lot of time rather based on delusional thoughts of like trying to figure out, problems before they happen, trying to stop problems before they happen. And the meditation allows me to stop those thoughts and prune them and distract them really from happening. I also liked what you're talking about, the skillful use of technology and work in the technology industry, and so it's very in my mind constantly. And I think it's something that technology is moving so quickly, and we haven't really, people didn't really think about the skillful use of technology, and I think it's being used for a lot of bad things and a lot of good things, as you're using them. And I think we're very, it's just that attachment. We're all attached to our phones, to our computers, to our TVs, and 99% what's on there is these delusional stories and, negative news stories and, it's just it's very hard for me to unattach from it just because it's my life every day. But when I find that I am able to, I am more calm and living more in reality as opposed to this delusional digital world that we at all live in.
Thank you. You said a lot, Tom. The idea that I need to be perfect, even as it applies to Dhamma practice. I have to get it just one. That's rooted in ignorance, isn't it? It's a self-referential view. I got to do this just right. And it's also an extreme view. So the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path as the middle way between all those type of extreme views. The sixth factor, the second time I mention it, we'll talk more about it next week, right effort, implies that we just need to be mindful of the effort necessary to develop. We need to meditate. If we want to gain the benefits of a practice rooted in meditation, it makes sense we have to meditate a little bit and develop the broader understanding of what he taught, the Eightfold Path. I asked that, you mentioned about the benefits of meditating with Bardhabhasanga. Very, very few people can develop awakening without the benefit of a Sangha, meaning they can be, and I mean, I know this from direct experience and many, many people that I've talked to that have an isolated meditation practice, and it's just nearly impossible. In fact, the Buddha said that it is impossible. You need to be part of a Sangha. Because of the, because of technology, I have students online that are in isolated parts of the world, and they don't have the benefit of a Sangha, and they use this. They're able to access through technology and feel like they're a part of our Sangha, at least in a little way. I think there's four or five people that have taken his class with us today. The rhetorical question that I asked, do you feel like you can awaken? You can, in this lifetime. The Buddha taught a path for human beings to awaken in this present lifetime. It doesn't mean that everyone will, but it's possible. It doesn't take endless lifetimes. It doesn't even take decades. It takes right effort, and it takes the entire Eightfold Path. Once that's engaged with and integrated in our life, awakening is assured. The Buddha taught and often said that if this wasn't possible, I wouldn't teach it. Again, he wasn't teaching he wasn't teaching religion. He wasn't teaching anything based on anything outside of ourselves. He taught something that we can develop through our own right effort. The Buddha described himself, post his awakening, as a rightly self-awakened one, meaning that he did it. He did it himself. Nothing was imposed on him to bring him awakening. And he taught other people to do exactly the same. If it wasn't possible, they would not teach it. Any questions about today's talk on this? So next week we'll conclude this series of talks. Our Donna dinner is coming up a week from Tuesday. Info on the website, but please come. A Donna dinner is a community dinner we have every year here in town at Love and Oven. Our Sangha, our entire Sangha is here, family, friends, the community. It's open to everyone, so there's info on the website. I hope you can come. Take care, Mary. Good to see you. Hope to see you next week. So we'll finish with metta, the Buddha's words on metta. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.